This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you that have some stories to tell. And that is the case today. We're going to visit with 93-year-old Bob Austin of Oakhurst, California. He has some neighbors, some pretty secluded area out in the countryside. In fact, I ran across a deer and a fawn just on the curling drive over to Mr. Austin's house today. But it's a much different landscape than the one he grew up on. We're going to go all the way back to 1922 when he was born and hear about his childhood. But each week on this program, as you know, we visit with members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. And we're going to hear quite an adventurous story today of a pilot who had to crash land, who had to survive for a few months in hostile territory with some underground partisans in Eastern Europe. You're going to hear all about it before we're done. But let's start in those early days. Why don't you tell everybody where you grew up?
I grew up as a boy on Oahu, an Army post. I was an Army brat. I left Oahu July 31st, 1936, and went to Fort Lewis, Washington.
And so many veterans who I've interviewed, because I ask every veteran about December 7th, 1941, so many of them have told me, I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. I'd never heard about it before. You were very familiar with Pearl Harbor, weren't you?
I was a mascot when I was a boy with a baseball team at Fort Shafter.
What does that mean, a mascot? You dressed up like something?
No, you're just like a bat boy for the baseball team, playing against the Navy or the Army from Schofield Barracks.
So you said you're an Army brat. Your stepfather was in the Army. And at that time, you know, I've heard a lot of folks who were there on December 7th. You weren't. You had moved off the islands by then. But what do you remember about that island culture before World War II started?
Had an awful lot of fun as a kid. We went swimming all the time, hiking, boar hunting.
Wild boar hunting on Oahu?
Up in the mountains.
By the time you left there, it's within 5 years of war coming to the islands. Did it ever occur to you that where you were living might be some kind of military target?
Oh, yeah. Fort Shafter was, I think they made it into a headquarters for the Army. It was above Pearl Harbor, up in the hills.
When you moved from Hawaii, which wasn't a state yet when you were there, you moved to Fort Lewis, Washington. And there was a pretty famous name who was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, who you got to know fairly well. Tell us who that was.
Lieutenant Colonel Eisenhower was a lieutenant colonel in the 3rd Division at Fort Lewis. My stepdad worked with him and was on his staff. And so when Ike went to the Pentagon, he went with him.
So your stepdad was there. So Ike also had a son who was around there at those times. And John Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower's son, was a pretty good friend of yours?
I knew John very well because we went to high school on the same bus together.
What was your impression of this man who would become one of the most famous generals ever and then our president?
I liked him very much. My mother worked for him when he was president of the Officers Club.
Oh, so he was president of the Officers Club at Fort Lewis before he was president of the United States. I guess maybe you could have seen some of those leadership qualities, huh?
Well, he was a lieutenant colonel, and then they took him to the Pentagon, and he went right up the ladder real quick.
Well, tell me what those years were like for you. So you're a teenager here around all these military guys, some who are going to become pretty famous. What were you up to during that time?
Pretty much normal things around the base, newsboy, and hiking with the Boy Scouts. It was a good time to be at the base. It was a wonderful base, Fort Lewis.
And you decided to join the Army Air Corps right after you got done with high school. So this is before the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. Where did that desire to fly come from? How old were you when you decided, you know what, flying would be pretty neat?
I wanted to fly ever since I was 7 years of age and saw the bombers going over to bomb the Kilauea lava flow.
Kilauea was erupting and there was a lot of lava coming out and they were dropping retardant or what?
Bombs to divert the flow.
So they were dropping bombs so the lava flows would not destroy cities?
Yeah, to try to divert it so it wouldn't cover the landscape.
I don't know if most people have ever heard of that before, that was a tactic.
They were called Keystone Bombers based at Wheeler Field, which is next door to Schofield.
So you're 7 years old and you see these giant planes going over and you say, yeah, that's what I want to do.
I always wanted to fly when I was a boy.
So how long did you wait to sign up once you finished high school?
After I graduated as an aviation mechanic, July 31st, 42, I went to Fort Lewis and took the written exams and the physical, and then I got signed up 15th August, 42.
So you had already gone to aviation mechanic school. Was that all with the aim of being a pilot someday, or were you thinking, oh, if I can just do this, that'll be neat too?
Well, I was thinking of working for an airline, which I did for a couple months later on, but that didn't last long.
So this aviation mechanic school, this is in Southern California?
Glendale, California.
And that's where you were on December 7th, 1941?
Right, I was in the boarding house.
What do you remember about that day? What happened? How'd you find out?
Well, all the fellas come running out of the building asking me where Pearl Harbor was. So I had to tell them because I had been there as a boy. So then the next day we went back to school, the Army was there with drawn bayonets and so forth.
Yeah, and I've heard, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who were in Southern California at the time, and life really changed. I mean, blackouts and block wardens, and there was a whole lot of suspicion and tension. How did you experience that?
There was a lot of so-called anti-aircraft search when the Japanese came and hit Santa Barbara, I believe it was. And I was up all night that night, and I was the only one that was wide awake. Everybody else was slept through it.
So what were you doing while you were up all night?
Just watching the searchlights, see if they were going to fire an anti-aircraft, which they didn't.
So all over the Southern California landscape, there are searchlights in the sky looking for Japanese planes because a sub had shelled Santa Barbara.
Right.
Were you a little scared?
Well, concerned.
And you already told us, after you completed that aviation mechanic school, you did sign up to become a pilot, and that's no easy feat. And it's not like you just say, hey, I want to be one, and they let you do it. You've got to pass a lot of tests and go through a lot of training, right?
Well, the written exam and physical. I didn't pass the physical first time around, so I had to go back. They told me to eat a lot of carrots, which I did, and went back and passed good.
So why'd they fail you on the physical the first time? Was it your eyes?
My eyes.
But the carrots did the trick.
Well, vitamin A, I guess.
Were there some challenges along the way with the training? Were there some parts that were tougher than others?
No, as a matter of fact, I breezed through most of the training because particularly in pre-flight, when they discussed the engines and propellers and all, I'd already been in the aviation mechanic school, so I helped the instructor.
You were the teacher's aide, huh?
Right.
So it was a breeze for you. So your dreams were coming true. Did you have an idea, though, of which kind of planes you wanted to fly?
Always wanted to be a fighter pilot, but didn't make it. I don't know why. They never tell you.
What did it feel like the first time you got up in the air and you were at the controls?
Oh, I loved it. Boy, it was a wonderful thing to be up there all alone by yourself.
What kind of plane was that in?
Primary flying was a Fairchild single-wing monoplane. Then the BT-13 was the basic trainer, which I loved flying that at night. And then the advanced flying school, it was twin engine. I graduated as a pilot May 23rd, 1944. Now we went from there to Tucson, Arizona for overseas training in B-24s. And then from there we went to Lincoln, Nebraska to crew up. Just a while later, we went to Topeka, Kansas, and then we went overseas.
Did you fly over?
No, we lost our aircraft because they told us they had so many planes, not enough planes for the number of crews, so we lost our chance to fly over. So we went over by ship, 22 days on the water, zigzagging my submarines.
Your first impression of the B-24, the first time you flew it?
First time I flew it, I just loved it. Particularly the power, had 1,200 horsepower each engine, plus supercharge. I'm one of the very few pilots that ever tried to loop one. I got up to the top and fell out.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Your son Randy, who let me know about you, said that somewhere you tried to loop a B-24 at 17,000 feet, and he figured you just stalled out and were hammering toward the ground. Tell me about that. Whose idea was that?
It was my idea.
What were you thinking?
I just thought I was curious if it could be done. If the CEO had known that, I'd have been court-martialed.
Did you have your whole 10-man crew on the plane at the time?
Yes.
What did they say about it?
There was a complaint because one of them hit the bulkhead on his head. He didn't like that very much.
Did you tell him that this was what you were going
to
do?
I tried to tell him ahead of time so they would hang on. Anyway, rattled around a bit.
So where were you?
In southern Italy.
Oh, this is actually overseas you did that. All right. Well, let's come back to that in a little bit. So you head overseas, and your base was in Italy. just south of Foggia. What was the name of that city?
Cerignola. 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 About 22 miles south of Foggia, which is a bigger city.
And when did you get over there?
Middle of October, 44. We landed at Naples on the ship the day that Wendell Willkie died. He was a Republican candidate against Roosevelt.
Did you have any idea what you were getting into?
I had no idea at the time.
And what about your crew? Were these, did you have the same guys you trained with in the States?
Yes, we all trained together at Davis-Monthan Field, Tucson, Arizona.
So you must have been a pretty tight crew by the time you got to Italy.
Yeah, a couple of them I didn't get along with. Didn't get along with the navigator or the bombardier, but the rest of the fellows were really wonderful.
And you were the co-pilot?
As co-pilot went over, and then we traded off. I have about as much first pilot time as he does.
And you flew all your missions with that same crew?
Same crew.
What was your first mission? What do you remember about that?
Linz, Austria. It was commercial. One big target that we hit was the Focke-Wulf fighter factory, Munich, Germany. We got the presidential unit citation for destroying it. And you wore a little blue thing on the right side of your coat.
Yeah, the presidential unit citation. So that happened pretty early on after you were there. What do you remember about that mission?
Kind of a routine.
Well, routine for you, but not for all the people listening. So I imagine your day starts pretty early?
Day starts, you take off about 7:15 in the morning.
You've been briefed before that?
Yes. You always have a briefing before you go out to the flight line.
They show you an aerial photograph of the target or what?
That's right. Complete details.
So then you take off, and how many planes are up there with you?
Quite a few. Our last mission in Czechoslovakia, 700 planes, 7,000 men.
That's insane. That's for people to imagine that. But those are just the American planes. Enemy planes are up there too. And that was my question of the missions that you flew. How frequently would you encounter enemy aircraft and or ground fire, the flak?
Seldom, because the black pilots from the Tuskegee Institute had B-51s along the Adriatic Sea coast. So they flew above us back and forth, protecting the bombers. They never lost a bomber the whole war.
So you had escorts on all your missions?
Not all of them, but most of them.
What did that mean to you to see those P-51s or those red tails up there?
It felt pretty secure.
Were you conscious of the fact that the Air Force, well, the Army Air Corps, was segregated at the time?
We didn't realize that until Truman made the decision to integrate.
So it had never occurred to you? You didn't think of them as any different than you guys?
No, no different. I wish I could have met some.
Well, I know a couple. If maybe we can connect you. So you're flying these bombing missions. Not a lot of fighter contact, but how about the ACAC? How about the guns from the ground?
The ACAC was not as accurate as I thought it would be. It was 88 millimeter. They could use them on land or air. In fact, that's what their tanks had, 88 millimeter.
And if you're in formation and that anti-aircraft fire is coming up, there's not much you can do to dodge it, right?
No, you have to fly straight according to the plan.
Fly straight through it, even if it's bursting right in front of you.
That's right.
You've already alluded to your last mission, but did you have some close calls before your last mission?
I don't recall any.
You don't sound like you were that concerned about your own safety over there.
Oh, I was concerned, but I was pretty busy handling the plane and making sure that we're in the proper formation.
Was that difficult, as tight as they had you guys stacked up?
Commanding officer said you either have a good bomb pattern or you're relieved the next day.
No pressure. Do you remember seeing or hearing about other planes from your squadron going down?
One in front of us, wait a minute, was back of us. It was number 4. It was right in back of us. But we saw it in the rear, you know. Got a direct hit in the bomb bay. They fortunately bailed out and got into Switzerland. In fact, I know who it was. It was Lieutenant Cassa and his crew.
But you saw that happen? You saw them get hit?
It makes a strange feeling when you see a plane hit right in front of you.
So you look back and you see this plane going down, and doesn't that tell you, hey, I could be next?
It's always that kind of scare, yeah.
Is that something you got used to over time, or was that always tough to deal with?
It was always kind of a strange feeling to see something like that happen. Of course, you know it does, particularly the 8th Air Force. They had a lot more than we did. B-17s were going down right and left. There was only a couple of squadrons of B-17s in the 15th Air Force where we were, mostly B-24s. Did you know that the B-24 was the largest number of planes built? 50,000.
And they built them in a hurry, too.
Willow Run, San Diego, Fort Worth, 50,000.
Yeah, that's a big number. And we still want to hear about the one that you had to land in a muddy Yugoslavian field 70 years ago. But for now, we need to catch our first commercial break. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Mr. Austin now and during World War II. And keep it here because Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.